Canadian whiskey across the border during Prohibition. Some old-timers claim that bootlegger traffic was so thick on Black Lake, you could buy a drink from the next canoe. Although he hadn't personally wielded the knife, Ursel Martel took the fall as an accessory to Renault's assault and stood trial. Despite maintaining his innocence, Ursel spent the next 3 years atoning in the Washington State Penitentiary at Walla Walla. Thomas Packard, in the meantime, fully recovered and soon afterwards married Minnie Drixel, the gal who, so it's said, had been the focus of their barn dance dispute. Ursel returned to town after his release from prison, sullen and embittered, with the Packard-Martel feud now turned up to a permanent simmer. Their feud seemed at an end when the Depression hit bottom in 1933, after the Martel family harvested the last of the old-growth timber on their land. Their fortunes steeply declined in the next spring on his deathbed. Old Zebulon Martel sold the family's acreage and timber rights to Thomas Packard. Old Zeb promptly passed on, with pen still in his hand and a scowl frozen on his face. Thomas Packard, magnanimous in victory and eager to forge a permanent peace, hired all of Martel's old workers, and in 1939 he closed and eventually tore down the Martel's antiquated sawmill. The third family that prospered mightily in Twin Peaks during the early 20th century was the Horn clan. Patriarch Danville Horn had founded a mercantile company in San Francisco that banked its first million during the California Gold Rush. The promise of the timber industry attracted one of Danville's sons to the area in search of their next fortune. Orville Horn arrived in 1905 and opened a well-financed general store and dry goods business that soon eclipsed the motley local competition, one of which, legend has it, suspiciously burned down. By the 1920s, as the bounty of the logging boom blossomed, that general store grew into a three-story anchor of the business district known as Horn's Department Store. Soon, Valley residents were treated to a selection of products as fine as the splendid offerings available in Seattle, San Francisco, or even New York. Representing the pinnacle of luxury values, the Packards and Horns provided a vital sense of social aspiration to the fledgling community. Together, they became principal investors in building the Bijou Opera House, a 250-seat jewel box on the main square that upon opening in 1918 became the centerpiece of local entertainment and civic pride. It served not only as a venue for high culture, visiting opera legends like Enrico Caruso and musicians of the first rank like Paderewski often adorned the marquee. It also served as a vaudeville house on the Orpheum Circuit, the Marx Brothers and a young juggler named William Claude Dukenfield, a.k.a. W.C. Fields, were only two of the great acts who early in their careers graced its splendid stage. During the 1920s, the Bijou did triple duty as the town's first movie theater and was the first in the region to be outfitted for sound when the talkies came along. The debut of the jazz singer in 1929 made unfortunate headlines, however, when one elderly patron, the town's last living Civil War veteran, heard Jolson's singing voice issue from the speakers and succumbed to a fatal rictus.
2. According to local records, the impetus to build the Bijou began in 1915 when, during a swing through the provinces, Caruso refused to play Twin Peaks, dismissing it as a backwater venue unworthy of his presence. 3 years later, suitably impressed and in possession of a fat check from the Packards, Caruso sang at the Bijou's premiere, TP.
The Horns, on the wings of these rising fortunes, a short time later created the town's first grand hotel, the Great Northern, built on the bluffs above Whitetail Falls, a short hop down a spur line from the railway station. In awe of the Great Northern's grandeur, most of the local hotels and rooming houses that had once attracted the tourist dollar immediately folded their tents.
3. According to the Gazette, once again, a coincidence, surely, the week before the Great Northern opened, their biggest competitor went up in flames. Below is an excerpt from the Gazette, TP. A fire of unknown origin destroyed the Sawmill River Lodge Tuesday night, one of the oldest establishments in town. No injuries were reported, but as proprietors, Gus and Hetty Tidrow, viewed the wreckage in the cold gray of dawn, they were heard to say they will not attempt to rebuild.
But hard times lay ahead. The people of our town survived the Depression through sheer grit, stout character, and the country's unquenchable appetite for wood. Then, along with the rest of America, Twin Peaks and Washington State put their shoulders to the wheel to aid the war effort when World War II shattered global peace. The constant threat of attack from the Japanese to the west and infiltrating Hun saboteurs from the north heightened tensions. The local premiere at the Bijou of the 1941 film 49th Parallel, which features an attack by a rogue Nazi raiding party in western Canada, sent local enlistments soaring and led to the formation of a volunteer watch that tenaciously defended the border until war was declared after Pearl Harbor. Spearheaded by popular law enforcement leader Sheriff Frederick Truman, the group that rallied to defend our territory was officially known as the Citizens Brigade and counted among its ranks our fittest and finest young men. For their service during the war years, they soon passed into local lore as the Bookhouse Boys, named for the old one-room schoolhouse out on Highway 21 that Sheriff Truman selected as their meeting place. Since being displaced by the town's first official school system in 1918, it had served as a lending library. When America officially entered the war, many of that first generation of Bookhouse Boys went on to serve with honor and distinction in every branch of our military, more than a few of whom made the ultimate sacrifice. The names of the fallen adorn the World War II memorial in Town Square across from the giant log. But the surrender of the Axis powers didn't mean the end for the Bookhouse Boys, who have maintained their admirable tradition of community service and the twin ideals of justice and literacy ever since. Proud members of the group's next generation included the sons of Sheriff Truman, Franklin and Harry, named for Presidents Roosevelt and, no relation, Truman, respectively. Twin Peaks is indeed fortunate that both boys grew up to follow their father in service as our local sheriff. After Frank served with the Green Berets in Vietnam, he returned to take the job after their father retired, and later a job with law enforcement in Western Washington, where his wife's family hails from. His younger brother Harry, already a deputy, assumed the office from Frank in 1981, ensuring that a 50-plus year tradition of a true man wearing the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Star continues to this day. Some believe the Bookhouse Boys' most remarkable achievement came in 1968, when its members made up the entire starting lineup on the Twin Peaks High School seven-man football squad. That hard-nosed crew went undefeated for Coach Bobo Hobson during the regular season, a first for our small community, the misprint on the old town sign notwithstanding, and then thrilled their diehard fans when they rumbled through the local, sectional, and regional playoffs to reach the Washington State Championship game. That epic contest ended in a heartbreaking loss to the Kettle Falls Cougars, 9-6. Thus ended, to this day, the best and only chance Twin Peaks High has ever had at hanging a statewide championship banner from the rafters of Hobson Hall.
4. That starting roster, engraved on a plaque beside the trophy case in Twin Peak High's main corridor, includes the following names: Frank Truman, Harry Truman, Ed Hurley, Tommy Hawk Hill, Henry Hank Jennings, Thad Toad Barker, and Jerry Horn, who was apparently the place kicker, punter, and return specialist. Ben Horn is listed as the team's student manager. At the bottom is a special thanks to our number one booster, Pete Martell. I've also come across a cryptic reference in a Twin Peaks Post column by Robert Jacoby in 1970 that suggests that something about how that championship game went down wasn't completely kosher. TP.
And finally, regarding that feud between the Packards and Martells, well, I'm delighted to report that it found a happy ending. Although both houses may not have been exactly alike in dignity, to paraphrase the bard, they did eventually fashion a storybook ending straight out of Romeo and Juliet. In 1958, the eldest son of Ursel Martell, affectionately known as Pete, winner of 6 straight Lumberjack of the Year awards at the Packard Mill, tied the knot with the youngest daughter of Thomas Packard, the deceptively lovely Catherine. After she returned home at the end of her senior year at Sarah Lawrence, Catherine and Pete got reacquainted at the annual square dance during Lumberjack days, where, according to tradition, the newly crowned Lumberjack of the Year can ask any woman present to dance a waltz. He chose the comely Catherine, whom he'd apparently had his eye on for some time. This was the same event, mind you, where the attack by Pete's father Ursel on her father Thomas had taken place over 40 years before. As they tripped the light fantastic, folks said you could see sparks flying from as far away as Whitetail Falls. Before the week was out, Catherine had set aside her plans to study in Europe for a year, and the happy couple announced their engagement. Who said true love only happens in the movies?
5. For anyone not yet convinced this amateurish slice of Chamber of Commerce civic puffery is pure fiction, the Romeo and Juliet reference should put those doubts to rest. See the following. TP.
2. Catherine and Pete Martell. By this time, an enormous class divide had developed between the two families, given how sharply their fortunes had vectored since the Martells sold their mill to the Packards. If the Packards, Capulets, were now the Vanderbilts of Twin Peaks, the Martells, Montagues, had devolved into something closer to the Cramdons. There must have been sparks flying at that barn-burning hootenanny. Pete and Catherine clearly produced, at first, a high level of chemistry that resulted in their hasty trip to the altar. But according to everyone around them, it wouldn't be long before sparks changed to daggers. Although they never had a child, there were, at the time, inevitable rumors of a bun in the oven that necessitated their nuptials. The loveless arrangement that resulted between these star-crossed lovers deserves a niche in the matrimonial hall of shame. Whatever affection survived between them issued almost entirely from the husband, a well-liked and simple fellow. Pete played checkers, not chess. Catherine played nothing but hardball. Despite his woeful fate, Pete's feelings for Catherine never wavered. Decades after his return on that investment dwindled into unrequited longing and, from her end, chronic contempt. His friends marveled at Pete's undying devotion to this Lady Macbeth of the sawmill. While in a local diner, I once overheard him explain to a friend, in these exact words, his formula for a successful marriage. As long as whatever both halves of a couple give to each other adds up to 100%, don't really matter how they divvy it up. Pete estimated his part of that equation at 70%, by the way, which most who knew him would agree underestimates his actual contribution. He also once, in a rare moment of candor, brought on by a few single malt scotches, admitted that Catherine is plain hell to live with.
1. So the archivist admits to first-hand knowledge of Pete Martell, confirms that the archivist is or was in some way a part of the community. We will eventually identify this individual. TP.
If Catherine Packard Martell had redeeming personal qualities, she kept them to herself. She did possess an icy Titian beauty and a temperament to match, while inheriting all of her family's most ruthless instincts and none of her gender's mitigating compassion. A local wag referred to her as a Packard by name, a Medici by inclination.
2. More confirmation that the archivist has personal knowledge of or contact with these people. There were no similar references in the earlier historical sections, which suggests the archivist was or still is a contemporary of these people. Or could it have been someone from out of town with the ability to observe them with fresh eyes? TP.
Only a few years into their marriage, Catherine entered into a permanent dalliance with the scion of the town's other most prosperous and prominent clan, Benjamin Horn, married at the time with children, someone with whom she shared a cutthroat approach to business and pleasure. She also remained unhealthily devoted to her older brother Andrew, acting as his hammer in business while he served as the friendly public face of their company. While they always got along, it seemed to irk Catherine no end that Andrew was also fond of Pete, whom she considered their social inferior. But Andrew appreciated Pete's lack of pretension, and Pete always made him laugh. The two siblings, and third wheel Pete, shared different wings of Blue Pine Lodge, the Packard compound on the shore of Black Lake near the mill. That arrangement persisted for over 3 decades, until Andrew married for the first time, late in life, at age 70, and that changed everything. 3. Andrew Packard Revisited. The document excerpted below, author unknown, was found in the bookhouse.
1. Confirmed. One of many volumes found there, all of which were catalogued by Agent Cooper in his notes. I've also confirmed that this one was typed on a vintage Underwood that permanently resides in the bookhouse. T.P.
The Andrew Packard Case. Chapter 1. March 15, 1989. A lifelong bachelor who'd always played the field while devoting his life to business, Andrew, in 1983, did something completely out of character. He lost his heart to a young Asian woman during a business trip to Hong Kong. Andrew traveled there on a 2-week state-sponsored trade mission to sell hardwood to emerging Eastern markets. He returned with a blushing bride, and nearly a child bride at that. Josie Packard. Her passport claimed she was from Taiwan, but she was born and raised in an orphanage in a provincial region of mainland China. Her marriage license states she was only 19 at the time of their betrothal. Since she claimed not to speak English, no one in Twin Peaks ever knew too much about her, which wasn't helped by her spending most of her time alone. The only friend Josie made here was Pete Martell, who shared not only their large and empty house but also a lack of daily structure. Pete's management job at the mill, for which he was well paid, had by this point become ceremonial. Not long after she arrived, Pete made it a pet project to teach English to Josie. She got fluent so quickly, anyone more curious than Pete would have asked whether she knew more than she was letting on from the get-go. The same thing happened when he tried to teach her tennis. How to handle rackets of every variety turned out to be second nature to his new sister-in-law. But Pete was always the last to read the writing on any attractive female's wall. The truth was that in Josette Mai Wong, not her real name, Catherine had met her match in cold-blooded calculation. That Josie was able to hide her long-play intentions under the placid mask of an innocent immigrant bride, while playing every side around her against the other, made her far more dangerous than anyone could have imagined. Catherine, who never trusted her and was always on the lookout for any hint of scheming in her rival, didn't even see what was coming until it was too late. This is part of the jacket on Josie put together by Interpol in Singapore just before she showed up in Twin Peaks. Last name, Fung. First name, Lee. Middle name, Chun. Suffix, Ms. Social Security Number, N.A. 21030219720304272X. Chinese ID Number. Alias. Last name Packard, first name Jocelyn, middle name Josie. Upright, autumn bird. Criminal class 8E, tier 6. Place of birth, Guangzhou Province, China. Date of birth, September 2nd, 1956. Sex, female, race, China. Height, 5 foot 6 inches. Weight, 105. Eyes, brown. Hair, black. Interpol, Singapore, June 7th. 1981, case file number XRT497. Subject's real name is Li Chong Feng, which roughly translates as upright autumn bird. Born September 2, 1956, in Guangzhou Province. Subject later claimed she was born in 1962. Father was a high-ranking Red Pole enforcer in the Siwang Triad. Mother was a legendarily beautiful prostitute known as the Lace Butterfly. Deceased shortly after her daughter's birth from a heroin overdose. During her childhood, her father rose to the position of Deputy Mountain Master, or second in command, for the largest triad in the region. Subject was raised and trained by her father. She studied criminality the way a street urchin in the Peking Opera learns acrobatics. A brilliant, if disinterested, student, she attended an exclusive private boarding school in Shanghai, where at 16 she organized and ran her own drug and prostitution ring, entrapping and extorting members of the administration and faculty in a brazen blackmail scam. Fearing her father's muscle, none of the victims would testify against her, and she graduated with honors. Beautiful enough to work as a runway model, after graduation she climbed to the top of the Hong Kong fashion industry and founded her own fashion label. It served as the cover for a cocaine sales and distribution system that spread into every corner of the emerging music, film, and entertainment industry there in the 1970s. She was identified as a person of interest in connection with a series of accidental overdoses during the second half of this decade, which eliminated many of her dealer rivals and a fashion designer with whom she'd conducted a public feud. During this time, it is believed she was initiated into her father's triad by blood oath, an unprecedented step for a female. By this point, Subject was fluent in 6 languages, maintained 6 aliases in different countries, and is still wanted for questioning in major cases throughout the Asian Rim. Her net worth by the age of 21 was believed to be in excess of $15 million U.S. She was as much feared for her ruthlessness as she was admired for her beauty. In 1980, during an escalating inter-triad gang war, her father was gunned down inside his Gongshou nightclub. When rumors surfaced that Subject had either arranged or carried out the hit herself in order to inherit her father's operations, her luck finally ran out. With this violation of the triad's most sacred oath, "Don't kill your boss," the triad's senior counsel turned against her, and a contract was issued on her life. At which point, Subject abruptly vanished from Hong Kong and has not been seen by reliable sources since.
2. Verified with Interpol sources. I believe it's also likely, the tone being consistent with what I've seen of his case notes, that Agent Cooper himself may have put together this untitled volume. T.P.
The Andrew Packard Case, Chapter 1, March 15, 1989. Enter Andrew Packard. We now know that Josie was actually 27 by the time she met her soon-to-be American husband, not the 21 she claimed. When the two met during a state-sponsored black tie mixer at the Hong Kong Trade Center, Andrew believed Josie was an art and design student from a local university, hired to work as a hostess for the evening. He was also sufficiently swept off his feet to buy that she was Josette Mai Wong, a plucky orphan girl from the slums of Taiwan, not a patricidal sociopath looking to escape a death order. Meanwhile, Josie had stashed whatever remained of her ill-gotten fortune somewhere offshore, while retaining enough ready cash to pull off her desperate gambit. To set this up and make her escape from the vengeful triad prior to Packard's arrival, Josie bought protection from a Hong Kong import-export man, a South African emigre named Thomas Eckert, using herself as collateral. During Andrew's business trip, Eckert made a successful play to become Packard's local contact in Hong Kong. When Packard left to head home, Eckert thought that Josie would be staying with him in Hong Kong. Her disappearance seemed to take him by surprise. If he knew that she'd left for the Pacific Northwest to join Packard, Eckert took years to find her there, which is one of the reasons to suspect Eckert knew her intentions all along, as part of a comprehensive plan he and Josie had devised. According to Pete, Josie told him she had refused Andrew's first proposal in Hong Kong as too impulsive, but then showed up at their door in Twin Peaks, unannounced, 3 weeks later and accepted, saying she'd needed some time to think it over. She apparently made that midnight entrance wearing only high heels, a mink coat, and Chanel No. 5. Blindsided by this seductive interloper parachuting into her life, Catherine thought her brother had gone mad. Andrew hadn't even mentioned Josie when he returned. When she failed to dissuade him from going through with the marriage, without even the prenup she begged him to make Josie sign, her shock turned to slow burning rage. Her grip on the Packard fortune was in trouble. While Josie played the part of the fragile bird with a broken wing to perfection, she mesmerized the guileless Pete and slowly and subtly undermined Catherine's influence with Andrew. Josie also cast her hooks into the new community around her. Local lout Hank Jennings fell under her spell, clearly no match for her charms, and began working as her accomplice in various ways. The next victim Josie foozled was more pragmatic, and her success even more surprising. Sheriff Harry Truman. A man of more pristine character in the region is impossible to come by, but Josie's charms were world-class. And Harry was a small-town guy who'd never found the right woman. The wrong one found him first. It's not known exactly when their romance began. I believe it happened after Andrew Packard's first death.
4. I have been waiting for this subject to resurface. Sometimes patience is rewarded. T.P.
Like many of his class, Andrew Packard was a boating enthusiast, and his prize possession was a 1936 40-foot mahogany-hulled classic Chris Craft Sportsman, harbored in a boathouse on the Packard's family estate, the Blue Pine Lodge, and rechristened the Josie just after their wedding. Andrew could be seen at her helm during the season, tooling around in his peacoat and captain's cap with Josie at his side. Until one afternoon in September of 1987, when Josie stayed home with a migraine, and the Josie exploded in the boathouse the moment, apparently, that Andrew fired up the ignition.
Twin Peaks Post, Twin Peaks, Washington, Sunday, September 27th, 1987. Tragedy at Black Lake, by Cyril Pons, staff reporter. A boating accident yesterday claimed the life of local businessman Andrew Packard, 75. Shortly after 9 a.m., an explosion rocked the boathouse at the Packard estate, Blue Pine Lodge. According to family sources, Mr. Packard had left the house to take his customary morning boat ride in his favorite runabout. Moments later, apparently when he started the engine, a blast erupted that was powerful enough to destroy the boathouse and shadow windows in the main house over 50 yards away. Fire and police arrived within minutes and pronounced Mr. Packard dead at the scene. Mr. Packard was believed to be alone at the time, and no one else at the scene was injured. Mr. Packard is survived by his wife, Josie, and his sister, Catherine. Mayor Dwayne Milford issued this statement a few hours later from City Hall. Our community today is shaken to its core at the sudden and senseless death of one of its most outstanding citizens. I've known Andrew his entire life. I was once proud to call myself his scoutmaster, and I cannot find the words to describe my profound shock and sense of loss. Andrew was like a younger brother to me, like the brother I never had.
5. A curious statement from someone who, as we know, most definitely had a younger brother. T.P.
Local police concluded that although there were plentiful human remains at the scene, the explosion had been so violent, it leveled a sturdy timbered boathouse that had stood for 60 years, that no identifiable human tissue could be found. Since Pete and Catherine had both seen Andrew enter the boathouse moments earlier from the kitchen window inside, the report concluded Andrew had been the only casualty. Josie claimed not to have seen the blast, but only heard it from her bedroom upstairs.
6. It just occurred to me that the film Body Heat, which came out a few years before this, has a strikingly similar plot twist. Maybe she saw the movie? Still worth watching, by the way.
Because so little evidence remained, the only conclusion insurance investigators could draw was that a leak in the fuel line near the ignition prompted the explosion. Since there was a 7-figure life insurance policy involved, as well as Andrew's recently redrafted will designating a new sole beneficiary, guess who? Josie became a figure of significant interest not only to the insurers, but also Andrew's bereaved, suspicious, and coldly vengeful sister. In cold black ink, Andrew had left the Packard Mill and all his assorted businesses exclusively to Josie. Josie now wore the veil of the grieving widow to perfection. She fainted at the funeral, and not a hint of impropriety came close to sticking to her. No connection to her criminal past in Asia ever surfaced. She possessed a rare and ethereal beauty that was almost otherworldly, one that women, Catherine excluded, were not threatened by, and that most men felt an impulse to protect. The Twin Peaks community mourned with her. Near the end of her period of mourning, around the time the insurance companies took a harder look at the accident, Josie first ensnared the good and decent Sheriff Harry Truman in her web as an insurance policy of her own. No coincidence, then, that at this point in the investigation, their interest began to drift away from Josie in the direction of Hank Jennings, the henchman Josie had hired and paid handsomely to arrange Andrew's accident. Josie was also gently nudging Sheriff Truman in Hank's direction. An aside here, a suggestion there. But it turned out that Hank had, conveniently, been arrested 2 hours before the explosion on suspicion of vehicular homicide, a hit-and-run involving Hank's truck on a highway near the border. All part of Josie's plan. A first-rate lawyer from Seattle, way out of Jennings' price range, bargained that charge down to a guilty plea on one count of vehicular manslaughter. Hank never stood trial and began serving a 5-year stretch in the state pen, knowing he had the cash Josie paid him stashed and waiting for him on release. A brief look at how Hank Jennings' criminal disposition developed is in order. It's tempting to see Hank as a bad seed that germinated into a nasty piece of rotten fruit on a warped family tree. His father, Emil, was a ne'er-do-well souse, about whom no town resident has a good word to say, since he owed most of them money.
7. Emil was the son of Doug Milford's erstwhile UFO witness, T.P.
Emil's uncle Morgan died in 1914 when he fell down drunk in a Spokane street after a 3-day bender and was run over by a beer wagon. Hank's mother, Jolene, was a hard-working, hash-slinging waitress at the Double R for 35 years. Hank was her only child with Emil, and Jolene doted on him, filling him with a confidence that surpassed the borders of his actual qualities by a wide margin. Hank grew up strong and sturdy, and was a more than competent athlete, which kept him out of trouble for most of his teenage years. The innate ferocity of football suited his temperament. He became a standout two-way player for Coach Hobson's Lumberjacks at Twin Peaks High. He also benefited from membership in the Bookhouse Boys, recruited by the Truman Brothers, where his somewhat surprising love for American literature blossomed. He favored Kerouac, Irwin Shaw, and, more useful to his later career, the collected works of Raymond Chandler and James M. Cain. Hank and Harry were close during their high school years, fullback and quarterback, respectively. The first sign of moral rot emerged during the 1968 state championship football game.
Twin Peaks Gazette, since 1922, only 75 cents. Issue 318, Volume 46, Twin Peaks, Washington, Thursday, November 14th, 1968. From the Jaws of Victory, by Gazette staff writer Robert Jacoby. Trailing by a field goal with less than a minute to play, the Twin Peaks High Lumberjacks were driving down the field for what it seemed would inevitably become the touchdown that brought the school and our town its first state championship banner. Then, on second and goal from the 2-yard line, fullback Hank Jennings took a handoff from quarterback Harry Truman and headed for a hole on the right side you could have driven a logging truck through, which tight end Big Ed Hurley had opened with a tremendous bone-crunching block. And without being touched, Hank coughed up the pigskin, pulled up short, and watched it bounce to the turf, where 2 Kettle Falls players fell on it at the 1-yard line, which brought down the final curtain on the team's and the town's golden hopes and dreams. Jennings, who appeared stunned after the game, confirmed that he hadn't even been touched by a member of the opposition. He explained repeatedly to anyone who would listen that the ball had simply squirted out of my hands like a pumpkin seed. "I must have tried to hold on to it too tight," said a downcast Jennings, trying to protect it too hard. "It was a good play," added junior quarterback Truman. "Just like Coach drew it up, sometimes the ball just doesn't bounce your way." Team captain and senior Frank Truman, Harry's older brother, offered only this. "We were so close, this close. It's almost a crime what happened out there." A few of the players and many students and citizens in the crowd were seen shedding many a tear after the game. Twin Peaks coach Bobo Hobson, in his 40th and some believe final year of coaching the Lumberjacks, remained philosophical after the game. "I should have invested in my brother's bar when I had the chance. While the town drowns its sorrows tonight, he's going to make a small fortune, and I can assure you, I will be among them." One dead, two injured in local accident. One man was killed and two others are hospitalized with critical injuries in a head-on crash involving two go-karts Saturday night. Eyewitnesses on the scene report it was a horrific sight. Reports came in at 12:25 p.m. of a serious crash on Trail 6F near Parker Road, and sheriff deputies along with the Twin Peaks Fire Departments responded promptly.
A few in the crowd that night grumbled along the lines of, "What else would you expect from a Jennings?" The rest seemed to accept it as yet another lesson in the bittersweet human condition in general, and life in Twin Peaks in particular. A few years later, a more unsavory scenario for Jennings's mishap emerged. A visitor to the brothel and gambling establishment known as One-Eyed Jack's, just across Black Lake on the far side of the Canadian border, heard a story one night that turned the accepted version of events on its ear.
8. One-Eyed Jack's figures prominently in an investigation conducted by Agent Cooper just after the Laura Palmer case, TP.
Jean Renault, oldest son of deceased family patriarch Jean-Jacques Renault, was overheard bragging during a poker game that he'd placed a substantial wager on underdog Kettle Falls in that game, and then fixed the outcome. When asked why he'd go to all that trouble to corrupt a high school football game, Jean laughed and was heard to say in thickly accented English, "Because I can." Given Renault's amoral viciousness, that's easy to believe. But in pulling that string, he also made an investment in the future loyalty of Hank Jennings. A few months later, after Christmas, Hank was driving around town in a brand new, tricked-out, cherry-red Chevy pickup. When asked how he came by it, Hank explained that he'd used savings, scrapped together cooking short order at the Double R over the holidays. You don't need to be Perry Mason to connect these dots. A few months later, Hank and Harry Truman had an abrupt falling out, a fist fight that erupted at the bookhouse when Harry confronted him about the fumble. Harry's older brother Frank and Big Ed had to pull Harry off Hank or he might have pummeled him to death. Did Harry connect the dots himself? I think so. But neither Truman told their father, the sheriff, about it, and the truth stayed buried inside the bookhouse. Hank and Harry were no longer friends, and Hank's slide to the dark side accelerated. That summer, Hank began making runs across the border, working for Jean Renault, a post-graduate education in professional crime. His personal morality followed a similar downward trajectory. It wouldn't be long before former teammate Big Ed Hurley had his own reasons for wanting to pummel Hank. During senior year, Big Ed and classmate Norma Lindstrom had become an item. Norma was head of the cheerleading squad and homecoming queen, a dazzling beauty from a modest family on the shabbier side of town, that is, where most everyone not named Packard or Horn lived. The Hurleys had been Packard sawmill employees for two generations. Ed's uncle had lost two fingers there, and Ed's brother Ernest followed in their footsteps. But Big Ed's teenage obsession with cars, trucks, and motorcycles indicated a different path lay in store for him. Norma's father, Marty Lindstrom, had worked for the railroad for many years before retiring to open an unassuming diner in the heart of Twin Peaks. This diner, and its extraordinarily good coffee and pie, has become, I admit, something of an obsession for me. Included is a short history which can be found on the inside of their menus.
9. Verified. Cooper must have really been into this place. TP.
Double R Diner. Welcome to the Double R. Opened in 1938, this restaurant was first known simply as the Railroad Diner, serving the sort of hearty fare they used to dish up on the Northern Pacific dining cars worked by founder and owner Mr. Marty Lindstrom. From the day they opened its doors, one of the main attractions were Mrs. Ilsa Lindstrom's famous pies, many of them family recipes from her Swedish relatives, including such time-gone-by favorites as gooseberry, lingonberry, and strawberry rhubarb. Mr. Lindstrom put up a big sign and thought that folks would refer to his place as Marty's Railroad Cafe, but it wouldn't be long before people started calling it the Double R. After the war years, Marty yielded to popular opinion and added the neon RR that adorns the sign to this day. After speaking with all the principals, I believe I've discovered why Big Ed and Norma, who were so obviously in love, never married. Again, I find Hank Jennings is responsible. Here's how. With American involvement in the Vietnam War at an all-time peak, Big Ed Hurley enlisted in the Army after graduation and headed out of town for basic training. Everyone assumed that Norma and Ed would marry first, but Big Ed, displaying a tendency to hesitate at crucial personal moments that never showed up on the football field, neglected to pop the question before embarking for Fort Dix. Norma hadn't yet realized that reticence was as much a piece of Big Ed as his inability to articulate his reasons for it. Sweet-natured Norma, who'd stuttered as a child and suffered from low self-esteem, simply assumed she wasn't good enough. That fall, Big Ed left the States to begin a 2-year hitch in the Command HQ motor pool in Saigon. With Big Ed out of the picture, Hank, who'd gone out with Norma briefly during junior year, began circling his prey. Hank's own mother, Jolene, had been one of the original Double R waitresses, and he'd worked there himself all through high school, where Norma was now pulling shifts on the weekends while attending community college, so they'd known each other all their lives. Hank approached her as a friend who shared her sorrow at the absence of Big Ed. That struck a chord with Norma. Like any good sociopath, Hank could simulate sincere emotions without actually feeling them. With Norma, empathy and sincerity went a long way. Hank was also patient and armed with a surplus of dirty money, which he wasn't shy about using to impress her. Norma grew to like the attention, and by November, they'd progressed from weekly lunches to occasional dinners. And then Norma invited Hank over to the house for Thanksgiving. Norma claimed later that by then the daily letters she'd been getting from Big Ed by military post had stopped. She hadn't heard a word from him for over 6 weeks, a period during which Big Ed later said he dropped her a line every day, addressed to the diner, and couldn't figure out why his best girl wasn't writing him back. It wasn't in Big Ed's nature to write his friends back home to check on Norma. Ed assumed the worst, that he wasn't good enough, and her affections had changed. I believe it's because at this point you could add a felony charge of tampering with the U.S. mail to Hank's criminal resume. Big Ed was supposed to come home for Christmas leave, but since he hadn't heard from Norma, he canceled the trip. He wrote one last letter asking for clarity, but Norma never got it. So while Ed spent the holiday drowning his sorrows in a Saigon PX, Norma was in the arms of Hank Jennings at the annual tree lighting ceremony in the Twin Peaks town square. That night, As the townsfolk sang carols and a fresh sprinkling of snow dusted the square's magnificent old 60-foot-tall Douglas fir, Hank slipped Norma a small present in a beautifully wrapped box. Inside was a big fat diamond engagement ring, no doubt stolen and fenced. She said yes. Norma's Dear John letter reached Big Ed 3 weeks later. Big Ed thought long and hard about writing back, but was so broken-hearted and prone to self-doubt that his thoughts got all tangled up and after a dozen false starts decided he couldn't express a word of what he actually wanted to say. So Ed hesitated, dithered, and then declined to act at all. Not that, as we know, such a letter would have ever made it to Norma, but at least he could have truthfully said he'd written one. Big Ed learned about their marriage after the fact, when a letter from Harry finally did make it to him. An intimate affair at the chapel in the woods, attended by both families and not a single bookhouse boy. But by then it was too late. Hank took Norma by train to San Francisco for a swank honeymoon, then drove down the coast in a rented convertible to Los Angeles, where they saw the sights and attended a taping of The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, who, as he did every year, had taken his show to the West Coast for a couple of weeks.
Postcard. Mr. and Mrs. Lindstrom. 508 Parker Road. Twin Peaks, Washington. 98065. Hi, Mom and Dad. From beautiful downtown Burbank. Los Angeles is so much fun. We took a movie studio tour today. Hank wanted me to take a fake screen test, but I was too shy. Then he somehow got us tickets to The Tonight Show. Johnny Carson is so funny and handsome. Sammy Davis Jr. was on the show, and he sang and danced and told funny stories about his friends. And so was this really funny overweight actor named Victor Bono, who read some of his hilarious poems. We were having so much fun. Lots of love, Norma. And Hank.
When they returned home, Norma threw herself into finishing her degree with the intention of becoming a nurse, but life had other ideas. Her father, Marty, was diagnosed with heart disease, and her mom left the diner to care for him. Then Hank's mother, Jolene, took ill, lung cancer, so Norma helped care for her while taking over management of the Double R. Hank was, by now, spending most of his days on the road, working for Jean Renault. With her vitality and vision, Norma transformed a serviceable greasy spoon into a place worth a special trip out of your way. She revamped the menu and opened a small bakery next door to produce her mother's pie recipes in greater numbers, selling them as a side business and eventually by mail order. She also redesigned the waitress uniforms, the crisp, distinctive white-trimmed aqua dresses they still wear today, and slowly turned a taken-for-granted community hangout into a source of local pride. Let me reiterate that the food, and particularly the pies at the Double R, and did I mention the coffee, are truly something special.
10. Yes, definitely Agent Cooper. TP.
Norma lost her dad in 1978. Her mom came back to work at the diner afterward, and Norma loved working side by side with her, especially with Hank's long and frequent absences. But Ilsa never got over losing Marty. The prospect of grandchildren helped sustain her, but Ilsa's health declined, and she passed suddenly one night in her sleep in 1984. The whole town turned out for Ilsa's funeral, but Hank didn't make it. Out of the country and unreachable, on business again. At which point, Norma realized there weren't going to be any children either. They'd settled into a distant and loveless routine. Every time Norma thought of ending it, Hank would do something just kind or affectionate enough to keep her growing feelings that they were finished at bay. Until 3 years later, when Andrew Packard was vaporized in his boathouse. And a few weeks later, Hank pled guilty to hit and run.
11. The first chapter of Cooper's narrative ends here. And my first question is, why did he write this? He obviously had become fascinated with and fond of the people and places of the town. Based on the date at the front, this was after the Laura Palmer case was closed, but apparently before he left town. Cooper had some time on his hands, so he turned his investigative skills to clearing up a couple local mysteries, like a concert pianist practicing the scales to stay in form. It's only my opinion, but it also seems possible he did this as an act of friendship, as a way to tell his new friends hard truths about the losses or trouble in their lives without confronting them. I believe he may have then just left these pages in the bookhouse in the hope that his friends, Sheriff Truman and Big Ed Hurley, both bookhouse boys, might come across them. No way yet of knowing if they did. T.P.
4. Love Triangle. In addition to fostering interest in reading, the rules of the bookhouse encouraged journaling in its members. A second journal from a local source, also found at the bookhouse, in the local interest section on the shelf right next to Cooper's work, picks up Big Ed's story from there.
1. Verified. This one was written by Sheriff Truman's chief deputy at the time, Thomas Hawk Hill. T.P.
The Ballad of Big Ed, Norma, and Nadine by Hawk Hill. My pal, Big Ed Hurley, came back to Twin Peaks a few months after Saigon fell in 1975. I hooked up with him there once in the fall of 73 during shore leave. I was a gunner's mate on a PBR patrolling the Saigon River Delta. Talk about a flat-out shit-suicide detail, but that's another story. Remind me to tell it to you sometime, and remind me next time I see him to kick the ass at the jerkweed who talked me into that recruiting center in the first place. If I can ever remember who that was, Hank. After a bottle of 90-proof brain grenades loosened up his tongue, Big Ed confessed he was still carrying a Statue of Liberty-sized torch for Norma. Now, I love the big, dumb SOB like a brother, okay? But breathe a word about Norma, and the dude goes in his full-out mope mode like a 12-year-old Girl Scout who lost her cookies. I grabbed him by the shoulders and told him to buck up, stop acting so buku dinky dow about his stale old stateside sob story. Nobody in our immediate vicinity, and by that I mean the closest 2,000 miles, gave two shits. The statute of limitations had expired on that heartbreak, and there was a surplus of local nookie in our current clique to help his little brain housing unit achieve a permanent state of amnesia vis-a-vis what's-her-name. He came out of it, slightly, but the evening crashed for good, as I vaguely remember, with Big Ed getting gooey-eyed over some Frankie Valli cheerjerker that dropped on the jukebox. "That was our song," he said. I kid you not. And that's when I split the scene. A firefight up the Mekong on my PBR sounded good compared to this episode of Queen for a Day. We exchanged a few letters over the next couple of months. I punched my ticket home 6 months before Big Ed, courtesy of some VC shrapnel I absorbed with my gluteus maximus, when some FNG, that's military slang for a fucking new guy, lieutenant, ordered us up the wrong fork of the river, nearly introducing us to the beautiful round-eyed woman who takes you to the big base camp. Back in Twin Peaks, next letter I get from Big Ed tells me that he's about to sign up for another hitch and go career army. The action he saw in the HQ motor pool wasn't exactly hot when he learned that family obligations were calling him back home. Ed had this sad sack younger brother, Billy, who'd been hurt at the mill. A stack of logs fell off a truck and crushed one of his legs. For the record, becoming the third generation of Hurley to get himself maimed on the job. They call it Hurley luck. You know those safety signs that they put up in workplaces? One in the mill read, "Number of days since a Hurley was injured." My old man worked 35 years in the field for Packard, in way hairier circumstances, and never came down with a hangnail. And by the way, don't ever call these guys lumberjacks. It'll really piss them off. They're loggers. Lots of native people did that job. We built the skyscrapers in New York, too. But it wasn't because we were fearless Indians, either. Not enough white people were desperate enough to do those jobs. That injury cursed Billy's spirit, too, what was left of it. Confined to a wheelchair, he went on disability and started investing those checks in the local watering hole. Billy and his wife Susan had a young son named James, still in elementary school. Susan pleaded with Ed that the boy needed his help and she needed him to read Billy the Riot Act. Well, Big Ed was up for the job, and the Army lost one hell of a mechanic. Many moons ago, during the Depression, Big Ed and Billy's parents had opened a roadside stand outside town selling eggs, fruits, and vegetables from a family farm. Best corn in the valley, by the way, well worth the drive. After World War II, when rationing ended and motorists hit the road again, Big Ed's old man, Ed, added some gas pumps and lucked into owning a viable business. For clarity, Big Ed had been born Ed Jr., but he came into this world as one enormous fucking baby, and so they started calling him Big Ed, even when he was little, which wasn't for long. Big Ed also came in with this weird gift for figuring out how shit worked. 5 years old, his mom would come home and find him field stripping the toaster or vacuum cleaner. She whooped him so good that pretty soon he could put all that shit back together the right way, too. By the time Big Ed got to high school, he could assemble a Volkswagen blindfolded and was working as a chief mechanic at the garage his old man added to what by now folks were calling Big Ed's gas farm. Me, I just called him the engine whisperer. And good thing he knew how mechanical stuff worked, because when it came to the human heart, the poor, dumb bastard didn't have a clue. Big Ed didn't even tell a soul, even me, when he was coming home from NAMM. 2 weeks after the last chopper got out, I walked into the bookhouse and found him sitting there with a 16-ounce Olympia in one hand and a copy of Catch-22 in the other. Big Ed's one-line review of Joseph Heller's masterpiece. This guy was definitely in the Army. For a while, Big Ed kept to himself at the gas farm, working his butt off, taking care of his nephew James, and spent what few hours he had at the bookhouse trying to get James interested in reading. He tried everything, man. Twain, Tarzan, hell, even Doc Savage. Good kid, James. Not a reader. Our former teammate, Frank Truman, who'd taken over from his old man as sheriff, tried to talk Big Ed into joining the force as a deputy. After pondering the decision for a month, he decided to stay at the gas farm to help out his old man, who had a bum wheel of his own, courtesy of, you guessed it, another Hurley mishap at the mill when he was a teenager. It's an ill wind that blows nobody some good, some old white guy said. So in his place, Frank hired another of his high school teammates and fellow bookhouse boys. Yours truly. Let me add here, at the time, I still had some resentment toward Frank, who was the one who first hung the Tommy Hawk nickname on me in junior high. Back then, white people still found condescending shit like that funny, you know, like F-Trooper casting a Jewish guy from Brooklyn named Jeff Chandler as Cochise. At the time, I was seriously considered moving to Alaska to work on a deep-sea fishing trawler. Yeah, I did need to have my head examined, and I knew it. And courtesy of the VA, I booked an hour in the company of their on-duty shrink to sort out some, shall we say, issues about Frank and my decision. 6 minutes into my soul-searching monologue, the doc shoots me a look and says, "Wait a minute, you want to work on a fishing boat in the Arctic? I'm from Alaska, are you fucking nuts?" For the wake-up call, just let me say, for the record, thanks a heap, Doc. And so began my own career in law enforcement.
2. A detail of interest. Tommy Hill was a full-blooded Nez Perce whose parents left their reservation years earlier, just before the Hanford nuclear site came online, lucky for them. His father, Henry, was a fearless, legendary treetopper of guys who climb the highest trees with cleats in their boots and trim the tops. Henry tree-topped for the Packard Mill his entire career, which is, according to the Department of Labor Statistics, the most dangerous job in the world, without ever suffering an injury. T.P.
Although Norma knew he was back in town, Big Ed waited a year before going into the Double R for a cup of coffee. I was at the counter myself that day, the moment that Big Ed saw Norma behind the register. He went all pale and gulped in some air. His chest swelled up like a water balloon. But Norma was hitched to Hank now, and Big Ed's vocal cords just shut right down. Norma's heart probably skipped a beat when Big Ed walked through the door, too. Life with that punk Hank was no bed of roses, but as usual, she took her cue from Ed, and he didn't give her one, so they just smiled politely and stood there mumbling some small talk so tiny that you couldn't find it with a microscope. The sight was so pitiful that I ordered a second piece of pie just to break it up. That's how it stayed. A creature of habit, Big Ed started and ended every day with a cup of joe at the Double R and usually ate lunch there, too. A blind man could see that Norma's marriage to Hank was shakier than hell, and Big Ed had 20/20. He wasn't going to do anything about it, but knowing it pumped enough fuel to keep the pilot light on that burning torch for years. Then, one Saturday, in late 1984, he ran into Nadine Gertz. When Ed's father passed in 1983, Big Ed took over the business. He put up this big new sign that he designed and built himself. It had a big glowing egg on it, a tribute to the family's old farm stand, and a mallard that he said symbolized his father's love for hunting. And he renamed the place Big Ed's Gas Farm. His nephew James, who by this point was like a son to him, worked weekends pumping gas. Nadine had been a couple of years behind us in school, though I can't say that I remembered her. Maybe Big Ed did, I don't know. She was driving her father's John Deere lawnmower to the gas farm that day for repairs at about 3 miles per hour. I just pulled my cruiser into the pumps and James was about to fill her up. Big Ed was backing up his tow truck out of the garage and Nadine was riding so low that he never saw her coming and backed right into her. James and I heard the crunch, tipped the John Deere right over, but Nadine leaped off that thing like an acrobat just before it hit the ground. She'd been a gymnast in school, but I don't remember that either.
3. Verified. TP.
Big Ed jumps out and runs over to help her, terrified and concerned. And she saw that expression on his face and I guess mistook it for something like, who knows with her, a romantic longing? I guess nobody looked at her exactly that way before. She keeled right over and Big Ed caught her before she hit the ground. So I hurried over in my official capacity, since I am an eyewitness, and I saw her jump clear right before the impact and stick to the landing, so I knew that she wasn't injured. But Big Ed didn't know that, and he's stricken, like he's crippled or killed the poor girl, and there goes his business and everything he worked his whole life for. So he's holding her, eyeballing her face for signs of life, with all those concerns ping-ponging around his head, and her eyes flutter open, and she sees Big Ed's dreamy, rugged, handsome mug staring down at her. And it's not like Nadine was unattractive or anything. She's actually kind of exotic-looking, feline-like, and dressed beatnik fashionable with a silk scarf and a low-cut leotard thing going on. And the first thought that goes through my mind is, well, that's that. She's in love with him now. And my second thought is maybe she'll take Big Ed's mind off Norma, and I'm concerned for my friend, right? I want him to be happy. This is all before any of us, little James is standing there too, realized who this person is. So the first thing she does is hug him, because she knows exactly who he is. We find out later that she had a crush on Big Ed since junior high, like most of the girls. And Big Ed's just so damn relieved that she's alive, he hugs her right back, and I know instantly, watching the medicine flow between them, what with his vitality and her rockin' gymnast physique, this thing is going to end up between the sheets and fast. I get this big grin on my face like an idiot, and James is staring at me like, "What's up with you?" I tell him I'll explain later. Big Ed keeps asking her if she's sure that she's all right, and she keeps telling him that she is, and he keeps apologizing, and she tells him it's okay, and the mower needed fixing anyway, and then she kisses him impulsively, and he breaks into this goofy grin since when's the last time that happened, and at that moment, he realizes he's got a little hot live wire in his arms, and all the lights go green. And we still don't, neither of us, remember who she is. So exercising my official capacity, I ask, what's your name, miss? And she says, Nadine Gertz. And that rings a bell for Big Ed, and it's a good memory. He remembers her in a gymnastic meet, vaulting over a horse. The name rings a dim bell for me, but I can't quite place her, so I go to obtain her vitals. Her dad lives a quarter mile away, and she's been living down in Spokane for a while, working as a seamstress, which is why we hadn't seen her around town, but she was thinking of moving back home and opening up a shop, so she was staying at her dad's and noticed that his lawn was overgrown, and he told her that the mower was on the fritz, so that's how she came to drive the John Deere down to the gas farm. Big Ed tells her not to worry about it. It's all his fault, like he's never said those words before. And he'll fix the mower for free. So in my official capacity, given that both parties are in resolution, I declare that there's no need to file an accident report. And since they're still stuck to each other like Siamese twins, I suggest that they exchange contact information. Then I nudge James and have him help me push the John Deere, which wasn't that badly dinged up, into the garage. What's going on? James asked, once we got inside, glancing back at his uncle. Both he and Nadine are on their feet now, shaking hands, and neither one is letting go. They're feeling the mystery, I tell James. What mystery? He asked. The mystery of life, I say, which you'd know about if you'd read more books like your uncle tells you. James grins like he gets it now. Good kid, James. Except his favorite book is still Charlotte's Web. Ed and Nadine got hitched 3 weeks later at the chapel in the woods. Boom, just like that. Same place Norma and Hank got hitched. All the bookhouse boys turned out for this one, minus Hank, who's permanently scratched from the roster. Turns out that the rest of us fellas vaguely remember Nadine from school, too, but it's not until the reception at the Grange Hall after the new guy, Sheriff Truman, just brought in his deputy, Andy Brennan, a few years younger than the rest of us and greener than grass, whispers to me that he was in Nadine's class at school, and oh my gosh, don't I remember what happened back then. I say, no, Andy. I was too busy getting my ass shot off in Nam by some tiny dude in black pajamas. Andy waves me outside like anybody was going to hear him in the Grange Hall with that rented cover band playing the greatest hits of the Young Rascals. Nadine's mother, Andy tells me, had health problems of the mental variety, and her father wasn't a picture of stability either, big drinker. They moved to town from somewhere in Idaho when Nadine was in the 7th grade, and when she was a sophomore, Nadine had an actual, honest-to-gosh, nervous breakdown and had to take off school for the spring semester. Really, I say, watching her slow dance with Big Ed through the window. Yes, Andy says. She went away to one of those places where people go to rest up and collect themselves. I say, you mean a puzzle house? Not the state one, Andy says. A privately owned facility. Her parents had a little money. Her old man had invented some kind of industrial flame retardant way back. How long was she gone, I ask. She came back for the fall, I guess, about 6 months, says Andy, but nobody ever knew why. She wore a beret and a scarf all the time and told everybody that she'd been a foreign exchange student in France. How'd you find out about it, I ask him. Andy says, I don't know. People just have a way of telling me things. Andy, it turns out, owns some kind of a 9th degree black belt in gossip, which is about his best quality as a law enforcement officer, and I mean that as a positive. Or as he put it to me later, you know, Hawk, I never think of myself as a gossip. I think of myself as an oral historian. You think that your friend Big Ed knows about Nadine's history? Andy asked me. I doubt it, I said, my heart sinking as I watched them dance. She had her feet on his, and he was twirling her around like she weighed a feather. No, Big Ed didn't have a clue about what was ticking away inside his perky new bride. And even though he now devoted himself to her happiness without a glance backward, it wasn't long before, somehow, Nadine put two and two together about Big Ed and Norma and his old torch. And hairline cracks started showing up in Nadine's psyche. Small remarks at first, and then an endless stream of questions followed by angry outbursts, a few of them in public. That totally buffaloed him, since the only thing he was guilty of was having a life before he met her. And then she started following Ed whenever he went to the Double R. just staring at him and Norma through the window while he's at the counter minding his own business. By now, he's getting the idea that his little firecracker might be carrying an extra load of powder. And of course, he doesn't know what to do about it or who to talk to, so he doesn't tell anybody. That fall, Big Ed and Sheriff Truman go bird hunting like they do every season. Nadine followed Big Ed then, too, 15 miles into the woods, thinking who knows what, that he was sneaking off to meet Norma at 4 in the morning for a rendezvous at a duck blind. That's when Big Ed accidentally shot out her eye. He had no idea she was even out there, creeping right into their line of fire. And she startles a bunch of ducks, and they rise up and shoot, and a single stray pellet of buckshot catches her smack in the eye. How was he supposed to know? A big, fat, heaping load of Hurley luck. Harry was right next to him when it happened, so everybody knows it was a righteous accident, including Nadine. But Nadine lost the eye. Of course, Big Ed blames himself when the only thing that he did wrong was marry Nadine before doing his due diligence. But now he's bonded to her by industrial-strength super-guilt. He nurses her back to health and devotes himself twice as hard to making her happy. But the loss of Nadine's eye put a permanent zap on her head. She starts wearing that pirate eye patch and gets stuck on the idea that she's going to invent something like her old man did to help save the world and help save Ed from a life of drudgery at the gas farm. Except she doesn't realize that that's the only life he wants, the one he chose and made for himself. And that included her. And now he had to live with it. So we have a confluence of events. Andrew Packer blows up in a boathouse, and Hank gets arrested and sent up the river, and 2 months later, Nadine loses the eye and most of whatever remained of her grasp on reality. One night, then, at the Double R, Big Ed is sitting at the counter, the weight of the world on his shoulders, and Norma sees him, for the first time, like she hasn't really seen him in years. It's a slow night, she comes over with 2 cups of coffee and an extra piece of pie, and the two of them get to talking. Really talking. Like they haven't talked in years. Not since Ed came home. Commiserating, consoling each other about Hank, about Nadine, about what a hash they both made of their lives and their marriages. Starting to snow outside, the first big storm of the season, about 3 days before Christmas. And over the next hour and a half, these two fall in love all over again. No, not even that, actually. They both realize that they'd never been out of love. Ed finally pours his heart out about all the letters he sent home from Vietnam, and she tells him she never got them. And she looks down at the day's mail that's sitting next to the register where Hank used to work, and she puts 2 and 2 together. I know, I was there. I was in the back booth grabbing a bite after my shift, watching it all happen with a big grin on my face. They didn't take any action, of course, no stepping out, no sneaking around. Big Ed stays true to his burden, but he and Norma are in it, whatever it is, together from here on out, no doubt about it. He starts coming into the diner almost every night after the evening rush, and they have these long conversations. Nadine stopped following him by this point because she's back in her workshop like a mad scientist. Okay, it's a poor choice of words. Working on her invention, a completely silent set of drape runners around the clock. And Ed and Norma tell themselves it's only a matter of time before things work out and they're finally together again. We'll see. Knowing Ed, he might even get around to doing something about it in another 15 years or so.
5. Doctor and Patient.
1. I'm getting tempted to visit the bookhouse myself. No telling what else you'd find on those shelves. The archivist now picks up the story again. T.P.
After losing her eye, while recuperating in Calhoun Hospital, Nadine was assessed for the first time in her adult life by a licensed psychiatrist. Dr. Lawrence Jacoby had returned to Twin Peaks from the island of Oahu in Hawaii in 1981, after the death of his mother, Leilani, and established a private practice in town, as well as a consulting residency at the local hospital. Jacoby had garnered a controversial reputation in the 1960s and 70s after publishing a series of research articles and then a book based on his work entitled The Eye of God, Sacred Psychology in the Aboriginal Mind.
2. Verified, TP.
In the book, Jacoby proposed a theory for the evolution of spirituality in early native people. Through the ritualistic use of psychotropic plant life by shamans and tribal healers, the book developed over a decade of anthropological fieldwork Jacoby conducted with Aboriginal tribes all over the South Pacific and South America. Work that he freely admitted, the sound you hear is Margaret Mead rolling in her grave, included his participation in the rituals he describes throughout, including at one point a short-lived marriage to a chief's daughter. The list of drugs the tribe shared with him, including peyote, ayahuasca, and various Amazonian mushrooms and rare frog venoms, would be enough to knock anyone's cerebral cortex into the next dimension.
3. All verified as local hallucinogens, the ingestion of which, I might add, might well encourage a hasty marriage to an Amazonian princess, TP.
Here's a small example from the medical establishment's perspective of the kind of long, thin branch Jacoby was crawling out onto in his book.
The Eye of God, Sacred Psychology in the Aboriginal Mind, by Dr. Lawrence Jacoby. One of the strangest components of the tribe's pharmacopoeia was a thick liquid compound they would let me try only once. It was reserved for the use of veteran shamans, and I only earned their trust to sample it after many weeks of attentive study and participation in their daily rites. They called it ayahuasca, and never would reveal its source to me, although from what I observed as they prepared it, a day-long process which involved both rendering and cooking, it seemed to me to include both plant and animal extracts. I was the only person to use the substance on this occasion, with the shaman and two apprentices attending me, and only after a 2-day fast, as the sun went down on the second day. At one point of their holiest places near the river, I was instructed to strip to a loincloth and kneel, while both my wrists were secured in loops of rope that were held by the two apprentices. The substance contained in a gourd was raised to my lips by the shaman as he uttered an indecipherable chant. It gave off an odor that was almost unendurably foul, and I gagged once as it neared my face. One of the reasons for fasting, I realized. Tilting back the gourd, he poured the substance into my open mouth all at once, and I quickly choked it down, attempting with all my might to ignore the urgent signals my body was giving me to reject it. I realized the other reason for the fasting. It hit my empty body with paralyzing force and speed. My nervous system immediately felt as if I'd set it on fire, and sweat seemed to simultaneously squirt from every pore of my skin. I closed my eyes in terror, my heart pounding. And as the substance overwhelmed my conscious mind, I lost all track of time, or even of being in time. I believe I almost immediately vomited, but no longer possessed any way of knowing how quickly this happened, or, indeed, if it did happen. When I opened my eyes, two things occurred. I realized that I was no longer where I thought I had been, and at the same moment, no longer knew who I was. My vision was both clouded and somehow enhanced, and at the same level I registered that what I was seeing was not what was physically in front of me. I also knew that the veil of reality had been rent, split, or torn away, and that I was looking into a different or perhaps deeper dimension, one that either underlies ours or that coexists with it, side by side, separated by the thinnest margin imaginable, one that our relatively primitive neurology prevents us from perceiving. As I looked deeper, an inadequate description for a kind of seeing that involved all my senses. Although not necessarily on a physical level, I realized there were living beings before me in this field of energy. As they drew closer to me, I realized that they could see me as well, and that my presence had drawn their interest. This alarmed me slightly, as I could not discern their intent. I mean, they might have been angelic or demonic, or perhaps hybrid creatures. There were many of them moving toward me, tall and humanoid. I realized that their interest in me felt cold, reptilian, neutral, but shading toward malevolence, lacking all compassion. A shining figure, much taller than the others, suddenly appeared in the midst, and it gave off a violet light, so bright and powerful it washed away everything else in my field of vision, nearly blinding me. I cannot honestly remember anything else about its appearance, which may or may not have been humanoid. My memory holds it closer in shape to a sphere that emanated a powerful impression of beauty, but in an almost purely abstract sense. The other figures seemed to either defer to this figure or recoil from it in fear. It occurred to me that the figure might have been drawn to me by some protective instinct. As the other figures withdrew or receded, the new figure moved closer. And as it neared, all my own fears subsided, and I felt a benevolent calm wash over me, an energetically soothing rush of peace, and then a sense of joy that swelled up in my chest until, well, I thought it might burst. A wholly inadequate